Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good afternoon. I'm Michael Berry, a book critic and frequent reviewer of science fiction and fantasy. I'd like to welcome you to Tor Books Presents Science Fiction and the Resistance. Please allow me to introduce today's four panelists. Charlie Jane Anders is the author of the best novel you'll ever read about the middle school friendship between a witch and a mad scientist. All the Birds in the Sky recently won the Nebula Award and is now available in paperback.
Booyah!
Anders was a founding editor of io9.com, the wide-ranging website about science fiction, science, and futurism. As the organizer of the Writers with Drinks reading series, Anders delivers author introductions that put all others, including this one, to shame. Cory Doctorow wears many hats. Science fiction author, activist, journalist, and blogger. He's the co-editor of Boing Boing and is a regular contributor to The Guardian and other publications. He writes for teens in novels such as Little Brother, for adults with Rapture of the Nerds and others, and picks up the graphic novel and business book markets with In Real Life and Information Doesn't Want to Be Free. His new novel is Walk Away, about building a utopia in the wake of disaster. A founder of io9.com, Annalee Newitz is the tech culture editor at Ars Technica, where her work focuses on the cultural impact of science and technology. She's the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Her first novel, Autonomous, is about pirates, robots, love, and property. Look for her as a frequent host of Ars Technica Live, a monthly conversation between Ars staffers and guests from the worlds of art, science, and technology. John Scalzi. John Scalzi is a science fiction author, online writer, and former president of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. His widely read blog, Whatever, has been, quote, taunting the tauntable since 1998. He's best known for his Old Man's War series, three novels of which have been nominated for the Hugo Award. And his novel, Red Shirts, won the 2013 Hugo. His standalone novels include Fuzzy Nation and Lock In. His latest novel is The Collapsing Empire. He swears it is not based on current events. Let's hear it for Tor Books Presents Science Fiction and the Resistance.
Are we all awake? We were all in New York City this time yesterday, and we were all on the same plane. So if we seem a little that might be why. So how are we all doing today?
It's good to be home. It's really good to be home.
I'm vertical.
Yeah. I've just been drinking coffee, used coffee. As Cory
puts it.
Annalie,
it turns out when she's on tour, she drinks just a sip or two, and then she hands the cup off to someone else and says, do you need half a coffee?
Cory has now been disparaging me, like, what is it with you and used coffee? It's not used. I'm not drinking it and spitting it back into the cup, so I promise you won't have to see anything like that here today.
You need to, like, start a sharing economy thing where people split their unbelievably expensive Bay Area coffees.
We need an app. You know, it's just like, I've got a coffee here. It's ready for you anytime.
It's like Uber for coffee, you guys.
Yeah.
Uber for coffee.
I'm disrupting the coffee economy here. Yeah. So, which is actually part of, you know, what we need to resist, I think.
So, we actually did this exact panel with this exact title yesterday in New York, Science Fiction and the Resistance.
None of you were there, right?
You didn't all get on the plane with us. We all kind of talked about tools for resistance and using science fiction to imagine surviving the traumatic events that we're going through right now as a country. And, you know, I'm excited to talk about it again. I actually was thinking about it a lot last night. I'm just going to kick it off.
Please do.
And I was thinking about how, you know, I've just, for the last 4 or 5 months, I've just been so angry. I mean, not to bring the tone down, I've been so angry that when I try to type at a keyboard, my hands are just like, I can barely make the typey shape because I'm so angry and I'm just so frustrated and outraged with everything. And, you know, Yeah, I mean, it's. I think we all can relate to that. And I think that turning that anger into stories is harder than it's ever been. And it's more vital than it's ever been. It's an incredibly important process, and it's not something that you can just be like, oh, well, anger comes in here and stories come out there. Right. It's a thing that you have to, like, really struggle with, I think, as any whatever you're writing. And if you're writing science fiction, you have to engage your imagination. And right, my imagination is just kind of curled up into a little ball.
Yes.
Being like, I'm trying to imagine how I'm going to, like, get through today, you know, and not to bring it down, but, you know, I'm being real. And so I would love to kind of talk a little bit about that, how we turn just this gut anger into being able to tell a story that means something to other people.
Yeah.
And I'd love to just throw that out to you guys.
Both of us are like, wait, we have something to say. I'm going to let you go first. Go.
Well, I was going to add to Charlie's sense of anger, and I think one of the things that's been difficult for me as a writer is the sense that it's very hard to intervene as a fiction writer into politics when so much of politics as we are dealing with it now in the U.S. is about creating fictions. And we're having a huge national debate over what counts as fiction and what counts as truth in the news media, which is supposed to be an arena where we basically deal in nonfiction. And that's very, very hard because I think at other historical points, at other points in human history, one of the roles of fiction has been to tell the truth by lying and to allow people to think about political issues in story that are very hard to talk about if we are dealing with the actual realities of whatever regime we're under. And that's why I think, for example, Soviet science fiction is so interesting. If you look at sort of Soviet science fiction from kind of the 1930s up until the fall of the Soviet Union, is that a lot of issues were worked out in fiction that people couldn't talk about openly. But what do you do when you're in the United States and the regime that you're trying to question is also propagating fiction? And when reality television is also fiction, is also politics? And so it's really hard. It's basically fighting fiction with fiction. And so I'm not really answering the question of how do you do it,
but
I'm sort of refining the problem.
You're helping like to define it. Yeah.
Part of what is paralyzing is how do you intervene in that? When what we desperately need is truth, how do you make your fictional story into a truth that people can use?
Not only that, but for me, one of the things is like I wrote in my acknowledgments to the Collapsing Empire, that I had been late writing the book because there was an election going on and I was just agog, right? And I remember I was at New York Comic Con last year and I was telling somebody, it's like, I turned it in late. And she was like, I turned in mine late too. And then an editor-at-large was like, you know, in fact, the entire spring line was turned in 4 to 6 months late because fuck, the world's on fire, right? And then when the election happened, there were two things about it that got me. The first was the immediate reaction that some people had was like, "Oh, the art in this administration is just going to be awesome." And because this is Berkeley, I'm going to swear. My first reaction to that was, "Fuck you," you know, because quite honestly, you know, the art of the Clinton administration would have been on fire too. You know, it's like art is going to take care of itself. But meanwhile, the people who are creating the art are all various aspects of angry and terrified and scared. I mean, just the simple fact that, I mean, here's a true thing. The two things that happened to me on the night of the election, the first thought I had was, I have never felt my white privilege harder than I did when Trump got elected. And the second thing is, thank Christ I got that ridiculous book deal from Tor, because I can sit out, you know, the next 8 years. But but everybody else I know is, you know, in that situation, and I'm in that situation too. I just had to ask Tor for another 2 weeks for head on, just as insurance, because every day I wake up and I'm like, all right, I'm going to write a chapter. Let's look at Twitter.
Oh my God!
And so part of the question for me is, there is no doubt that I and other creative people, you know, our response is not curl up in a ball. We're like, all right, motherfuckers, is this what we're going to do? We're going to do it, right? But there's the difference between saying, yes, we are absolutely going to be part of the resistance, and the day-to-day onslaught of, here's today's shit, oh, and here's more, oh, and it's 5 o'clock on a Friday, so let's dump all the shit so you can't do anything for your weekend. and dealing with that, how does one resist when one just keeps taking one punch after another to the face and the brain?
Corey, answer us.
Yeah, I want to talk about how to make sarsaparilla when life gives you SARS.
Right.
So, and it's a mild gloss on the thing you were rightfully skeptical of, this idea that under conditions of adversity, people make good art. And I think the right way to think about it is, under conditions of adversity, how do we make good art?
Right.
And I went to the Clarion Writing Workshop, which I think all of us have taught, right? Or three of us have taught, sorry, Annalie.
You will.
It's all good.
One day.
And on the first day, unbeknownst to me, I got the best piece of advice I was going to get in this six-week, very intensive writing workshop. I probably could have gone home 24 hours in and retained most of the benefit. And I was a callow youth, and I had then, as I do now, glibness privilege, and so I could write a story that, like, read very fluidly, and so they called for stories to be turned in for the first day to be workshopped before any of us had written anything, and I had this audition story. I was very happy with it. We passed it around. People were really, really positive about it. Went around this circle, 17, 18 people were very, very effusive, and we got to James Patrick Kelly, who was our inaugural instructor that week. And Jim said, Cory Doctorow, you are an asshole. You have written this story that's so smooth and polished that 18 otherwise very smart people managed to read it without noticing that it's not really about anything and doesn't access any emotional depth at all. Go and figure out how to find the strong emotions that make you uncomfortable and then how to put them in your work. Yep. And there is an element of, like, all good work that involves finding the stuff that makes you feel uncomfortable, mm-hmm. and then like probing a crack filling with your tongue, just kind of poking at it over and over again, getting closer and closer to it, and trying to bring it out, and trying to make someone else feel it, try to accomplish that. And I'm interested, John, in your reaction, because it's funny, because, like, I spend a lot of my time in the same doldrums that you're describing, only because, like, I work on all these policy fights where we're hopelessly overmatched and where normally we lose except for when we win, and it's always very improbable. And I spend a lot of time just feeling like, oh my God, it's us against the universe and the universe is winning. Mm-hmm. And what's really funny is I've seen you, John, both in person at events that we've done together and then, like, online. You have this kind of, like, Six Sigma limbic system where, like, you can be in a situation which people are furious with you and you appear to be, like, not experiencing any fury. Like you're not mirroring that fury, you're just enjoying it. And so what I wonder is, like, what is it about this kind of strange, this different way that we both deal with things where I spend a lot of time thinking, oh, it's all going to shit, and you spend a lot of time thinking, well, we'll probably steer clear of it, it'll be okay. And then when it's going to shit, I'm like, well, it's still going to shit, and you're like, oh, it's really going to shit, what are we going to do?
Well, I mean, one part of it is I do think I'm 3% sociopath,
right?
So that, and in this case, it's a saving grace, because there will be moments that happen where everyone else is losing their shit, and I'll be like, okay, let's work this problem. And then once the problem's solved or we're clear of that particular problem, it's like, now I'm going to go backstage and pee myself, right? Mm. So that is one advantage. But the other thing, and I was having lunch with Cameron Hurley and Toby Bacall. About a month ago, because we all live in the same area, and we say, let's have lunch once a month and check in and stuff like that. And so we were talking about events, and I was, and I was doing the scenario where I was like, this is all crap, but here are the things that we can be optimistic about. And Cameron Hurley just looks at me and she says, yeah, but optimism is your brand. And she's not wrong. And part of the reason that optimism is my brand is partly that's just my brain. Because, my brain is, how do I spec this up? But part of it is, it's an acknowledgement, part of it is, straight, white, rich dude, right? And because I have those things, because I have those privileges, most of them completely unearned, there is that thing, like I said, you know, the first night, I'm like, I've never felt whiter, I have this contract, I'll be okay. But part of that comes with the response, with the thing of, okay, so I know I'm going to be okay, you know, unless I'm not, and if I'm not, we're all screwed. But what do I do with that okayness? What is it that is my responsibility as the guy who is going to drown last? How do I work that? And part of me dealing with that is working the problem of going back for the people who are screwed. You know, coming back and saying, I know you're not going to listen to this person because for whatever reason you've decided not to listen to them, but I can stand right here, motherfuckers, and tell you something, and you cannot ignore me because I am who I am. And that's the thing that gets me through the day, because oddly enough, the thing that makes me drown last is the thing that means I can say things that other people are shouting at the top of their lungs, but people are choosing not to listen to. They fucking have to listen to me.
Yeah. And so I want to kind of drag us, since I started us on this kind of downer note, I want to kind of drag us back to the topic of science fiction and the resistance. And for me, like, actually the advice that James Patrick Kelly gave Corey is advice that I think about a lot, although I never got that particular advice about, like, write the hard story. Write the story that scares you. Write the story that goes to places that you emotionally are kind of having a hard time dealing with and inhabiting. And I feel like, you know, one of the things that I love about writing science fiction is that it is this powerful act of imagination. It is, you know, you have to kind of reject the world that we are all stuck in one way or the other in order to create a science fictional version of it. And it's almost like a muscle, I feel like. It's a muscle that you exercise. And it does come in part from a place of anger and rejection and, like, screw this world. But it also comes from a place of, you know, I really do believe that there's no way things have to be. There's no natural order. And, you know, for me, I'm going to repeat what I said yesterday, which is that part of what I love about writing stories is imagining people surviving, imagining people who get through it, people who keep their hope and their optimism in the middle of unbelievably bad circumstances at some points, sometimes, and just people who have these powerful emotional journeys that aren't purely defined by the evil government they're living under, but, you know, they have lives outside of that. And I think that that's something that you can do in science fiction. And, you know, I feel like it is an act of resistance to imagine a different world and to think about how we could make a different world. And I feel like that's what a lot of us are trying to do. And I think that that's more important than ever. And I think it's just, you just have to, that muscle that I was talking about, you have to just work it out every day.
I think that's completely true. And in my work as a nonfiction writer and also a fiction writer, I'm a hope dealer. My previous book, which I think is going to be for sale out there, is an optimistic book about mass extinction, which a lot of people find confusing. But we are in the early stages of a mass extinction. There have been mass extinctions on Earth before. And part of what I wanted to do in this book, which is a speculative work, but is also completely grounded in science and is about kind of the state of the art in science around looking at what is a mass extinction, part of what I wanted to do was get people to step back a little bit, get out of the immediacy of the everyday, these problems, and think about deep geological time. Like, just cast your mind back half a billion years, which is kind of, we think of that as like a cool time for life because that's when multicellular organisms came along and, like, we're super into that because we're multicellular and we don't like, I mean, whatever, you don't like single-celled organisms, well, whatever. They're going to take over eventually, so. But what I do in my fiction as well is try to give people that big picture and to look at how, you know, in my nonfiction, how other species survived mass extinction, because not everyone dies. And also, how will we make it through to the future from this place that we're in now, which is a really dark place, both politically, but also it's a dark place physically, environmentally, partly due to our own interventions into the ecosystems around us. We've perturbed the carbon cycle, you know, that we're looking at going into at least 1,000 years of really, really weird weather fluctuations and temperature changes and habitat changes. So how do we kind of gain hope when we're facing all of that? And I think part of the answer is acknowledging that even when there are dark times, there will be these moments of survival and there will be these moments where people can make it through, but also that we can't get too confident about that. We can't sort of say, all right, we band together, we form the Avengers, you know, we defeat the bad guy, because the bad guy is kind of always going to be lurking there. And I think that this comes back a little bit to what John was saying about feeling white after the election, because it was white people who elected Trump, and it was white supremacy that motivated a lot of those voters and racism. And I think that a lot of, you know, people like me, whites living in the Bay Area, it was kind of shocking. Like, wait, what? We thought that that form of white identity was kind of dead. But
surprise.
It wasn't. Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it wasn't completely surprising because, I mean, obviously I live in the world. But it was, I think, an example of how sometimes these sort of residual types of belief systems from the past continue up into the present and bite you in the ass just when you think, like, okay, we finally made it. We had a black president. We're finally acknowledging police brutality against black people. This is finally a moment where a lot of this white supremacy stuff is really being so marginalized that we can forget about it. And it's like, nope. You have to be able to think about both of those things, the kind of the strand of hope that will take us into the future, that will bring us together, but also the kinds of belief systems that will hold us back and that will, you know, leave us on a planet that has, you know, some pretty messed up ecosystems and other political problems.
There's this saying that the future composts the past. That, you know, this tabula rasa, where we live through the era of X and then we enter the era of Y, and
yeah.
X is gone forever. It's not true. I mean, we have more light opera now than we did 100 years ago. It's just been so eclipsed by other forms of media that it seems comparatively small. And that's true of lots of other things that we thought of as dead and which are alive and well, mechanical watches and whatnot. And
records,
novels,
records, yeah. Novels. Yeah, indeed. Right. And, you know, there is this, we said yesterday on the panel, and I thought it bears repeating, that world building is political and politics are a form of world building. That when you say, you know, in the UK, it's interesting, they call party platforms, they call them manifestos, which I think is a rather bold but refreshing bit of honesty. And when you say, here in my manifesto is the world we're going to build, you're doing something between writing a D&D module and a prospectus for a novel to kind of explain a thing. And oftentimes there's a bit of Magic Underpants gnomes thinking where it's like, step A, we are here. Step 3, this is where we're going. Step B, who knows? Yeah, question mark, question mark. But somehow I will get us from 1 to C. Yes, 1 to C. So I think that, like, as against that, it is not, when someone is world building, when someone is designing a system, it is not pessimistic for that person to say, this system will have problems, and unforeseeable problems. Mm-hmm. As I said this morning, it is not optimistic to say, I've designed a machine and it will never fail. Right? That's just dumb. Right? That's like, that doesn't give you good machines. That gives you the Titanic. Right? It is an optimistic thing to say that I have designed a machine, and when it fails, instead of exploding into white hot shrapnel and killing everyone around it, it will coast to a gentle stop and we'll figure out how to get it started again. And a lot of my favorite dystopian science fiction is about people getting behind the machine that is finally worn out, figuring out what parts need replacing, and then getting their shoulders onto its rear fender and giving it a good hard push to see if they can get it started. And that's a really exciting mode of fiction. And I think one of the challenges we face as science fiction writers who are dueling with pessimism and optimism or sure. fatalism or cynicism is is whether it's more exciting, because we have to tell exciting stories, whether it's more exciting to tell a story in which disaster occurs and disaster becomes catastrophe because people are fundamentally all bastards, or to tell a story in which disaster occurs and disaster is turned into triumph because people are mostly good. We're a mixed bag, and in the right circumstances and under the right conditions, we can rise to the occasion and find ways to pull out. I find those stories unbelievably satisfying, especially if the villain isn't people who are bastards, but if the villain is people who think people are bastards.
Right.
Those people are usually the villains.
One of the things I also want to talk about when we're talking about resistance and we're talking about world building is that there's no one way to do this sort of thing. I mean, I'll give you a couple of examples. I mean, one of the obvious ways that you can talk about or you can promulgate a political view or view of resistance in your book is to basically do a close to one-to-one thing in your story where you're isolating one particular aspect or trouble of the world, you blow it up to its logical consequences or whatever, and it's very clearly a parable. And that's really overt sort of world building, where you're basically putting a blinking neon sign that says message, 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 message. And there's nothing wrong with that as long as you have the chops to do that. On another level, there's another subtler way of doing that, which is to build, for example, like a universe that has a representation of people or ideas that you simply want to see. And you don't have to call attention to it, or you can if you choose to, but you just have that as, in this universe, this is the base state of the way things work. And I'll give you an example of that. I wrote The Human Division, which is the fifth book in the Old Man's War series. And one of the things that I was careful to do as I was writing it, but I didn't talk about, was make sure that among the characters who were lead characters in their stories or were in positions of power, that the gender balance was as close to 50-50 as I could make it. Because I believe in a future where, you know, that's going to be a thing. And I didn't call attention to it. I didn't make a big deal about it, and one of the things that I did when we put it out was I waited until somebody wrote me an angry letter. You have too many women in power. It's just really unrealistic.
Oh.
And that letter eventually came. It took 18 months, right?
Wow.
And what does that tell me? One, it suggests my readers aren't bastards, so that's good. Thank you. But the other thing is that by creating a universe in which that was just the way it was, people were absolutely willing to accept, like, yeah, that is actually the way the universe is. And I think that's, and it's a subtle thing, and it's not flashy, and it's not showy, but in terms of world building, this is what I'm saying, where you can do it on overt levels, and you can do it on subtle levels, and all of it counts.
Yeah, and I was actually very blown away when I read The Collapsing Empire by, like, the very female-dominated queer cast of characters who just are in charge, and it's not a big deal. And, you know, I think one of the reasons to be optimistic about the state of science fiction right now and science fiction as an instrument of resistance is the fact that we are starting to decolonize it and starting to add voices that have been pushed out.
Yes.
And, like, you know, I was at the Nebula conference a couple weeks ago, and, you know, people were telling me that they had been having a hard time writing since the election, but also, at the same time, it was very encouraging because this slate of nominees was just a who's who of, like, brilliant young, you know, and not, in some cases, not young authors of color, women, trans people. Just groups that had been shut out in the past were now front and center, and it wasn't, you know, because it was because they were writing some of the most exciting stuff right now, and because we're just recognizing that there are so many great stories to be told and so many great things. One thing I wanted to bring up really quickly, actually, when I was talking about anger before, is that, you know, John and I are both kind of, we're kind of labeled as funny writers or whatever. And, you know, I used to struggle with this idea that, you know, comedy and humor comes out of anger, and that every stand-up comedian is really an angry person, and that you make jokes instead of like screaming or whatever, which I think has an element of truth to it. I finally realized that that's not the entire truth. Mm. I think part of the truth, like if you watch John Cleese, like classic John Cleese, he is clearly incredibly pissed off all the time, and that is what drives his performance. And he actually became more well-adjusted later in life and becomes a lot less funny. It's just a thing. But at the same time, you know, I think that you can turn anger into humor. I think there's other ways to have humor, which is like character-based. John does a lot of humor where it's actually kind of gentle, and it comes from characters kind of joking together, which is really nice. I feel like, you know, right now, speculative fiction is really very good at delivering absurdity and pointing out how silly our world is by just tweaking it a little bit. Like everybody from like Douglas Adams to the not particularly funny Philip K. Dick had managed to present the kind of absurdity and silliness of our world by just kind of like tweaking it. And I feel like that is one way that you can actually provide a valuable tool for resisting what Anna Lee was talking about, where everything is fiction, nothing is real. You know, we can't even agree on up and down or, you know, any basic things about the state of the world. But, you know, if you can just take it to an absurd extent, and I was moving away from absurdity and silly, like really silly comedy, but I feel like actually that's one of the most, coming back to it now because I'm realizing it's one of the things that you can do that's actually, can be really powerful.
So I want to name check a writer who built a career on letting his anger with politics turn into stories that still resonate today, and that's Rod Serling. You know, sure. Whose whole career was built on like being angry at McCarthy, and where he danced on a knife edge of being canceled or being hauled up in front of a committee or being blackballed through the whole time. And it's kind of a template for exactly how much longer those stories can last than even the, like, we don't remember the name of the person who made Rod Serling angry anymore, but we remember the stories Rod Serling's told about it. They continue to resonate to this day. Sure. And you know, that process of turning fear and anger into really compelling stories is one of science fiction's signature motifs. William Gibson often says that Neuromancer is not a dystopian novel because he wrote it in 1984 or 1983 and published it in 1984, and he set it in like 2010 or whatever, and there had only been one limited nuclear exchange. And he said, you know, if it were a pessimistic novel, all the great cities of the world from the perspective of 1984 would just be blowing clouds of radioactive ash. And he did a really optimistic thing against that backdrop, which is he told a story in which networks and computers became more fierce, more totalizing, more ubiquitous, and in which, famously, the street found its own uses for things, in which if they became tools of resistance.
Really, really quickly, and then, sorry, super quickly, I just wanted to add to that that, you know, when Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett were on tour for Good Omens. Terry Pratchett famously told Neil Gaiman, never forget, anger gave us this book. Anger created Good Omens. And I feel like...
Yeah.
What do you feel like?
I feel like that's something, you know, that's a hilarious, fun book, but it comes from a place of rage.
I was going to add that rage doesn't always lead to humor, which I think it is a very productive place for it to go. But one of the other parts of rage is sadness and sorrow. And I think a lot of times when we kind of peel back our anger, that's the feeling that's lurking underneath it. And I think that we sometimes forget how much sorrow is an important political tool. And I'm not talking about the kind of sadness that's paralyzing, where we're like, I'm just such a bad person, you know, like I helped ruin the environment because I'm a human being, and so therefore, you know, I should just flagellate myself until I die, which is sometimes the position that people take. I'm talking about the kind of sorrow that's productive, where you realize that you fucked up, and you say, all right, I figured out the problem, whether that problem is a political problem or screwing up the environment, and you say, and now I'm going to fix it. And I think that a lot of great science fiction comes from that place of looking at how humans can fix their own problems. And I feel like one of the things that's really paralyzing for us right now politically is feeling like we can't fix our own problems, that we just need to sit and feel guilt and just that's what we should do because we've just been so terribly naughty. And no, I mean, the appropriate response to doing something wrong is making it better. And that's why I think a lot of, yeah. No. And so I think that's why a lot of science fiction that is coming out that's both dystopian and utopian in tone, like Corey's Walk Away or Toby Buckle's novel Arctic Rising, which I highly recommend if you're if you're interested in really smart ecological science fiction. The thing that's great about Arctic Rising is it's a world where global warming has opened up the Arctic. And so, you know, a lot of us think that that's the worst nightmare. You know, there's no more ice in the Arctic. But what's happened is that marginalized political groups have been able to move into that space and to have spaces of sovereignty there. And so suddenly this thing that's sort of ecologically horrific has led to new kinds of political freedoms. It's very crunchy and smart and kind of thinking about all of the different implications. And at the same time, you know, characters are struggling with how do we kind of fix the environment as well. And I think that, again, having that aspect of acknowledging the mistakes we've made and trying to move beyond them with our world building is really important. So I think we should laugh. I think we should make fun of ourselves. But I think we should also take that moment to feel really sorry and then just frickin' move on. You know, get over it and start changing things.
You know, the thing, though, is that I've never really had the, I need to have that moment of sorrow. I just go straight to rage, you know? which actually is the thing, is because rage can be a motivator for humor. Rage can be a motivator for introspect and sorrow and then, you know, acceptance and moving on.
Fixing shit.
Yeah. But sometimes rage can just be rage. And I think that we also need to acknowledge that there is something good and cathartic about sitting there and not just sitting there, but acknowledging that what you really feel is really, 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 really pissed and angry, and that can be a motivator as well. And I think that the part of, you know, a lot of the reasons why we sometimes deflect into humor, or not necessarily deflect, but go into humor or go into sorrow or go into, because we are compensating for the idea that rage in and of itself cannot be positive. But I, you know, I don't say rage and then burn down the house, usually. But I do think that, and one of the smartest things that I ever learned from my wife, who is just an amazing human being in all sorts of ways, but I tend to be an overthinker. You know, it's like I will go, I'm here and I need to go here, and I will go over here, and I'll think about why I need to be over here, and then maybe go, well, what does this really mean? And I'm over here. And she's just like, idiot, straight, right? Just do that. And one of the things that she does is when she's angry, she's angry. And she is angry, and she has that moment, and she deals with her shit, and then she's like, okay, now let's move forward with that. I think that as writers and creators and people, that acknowledging that rage and acknowledging that rage is valid, and acknowledging that that can be a motivator for the art that we do, instead of or in addition to deflecting it into other things, is really important. There can be just really, really angry work that when people read it, they just feel the heat of what's coming off of you, and it changes them.
I'm sorry, Annalie, you go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I think that there is a lot of great work coming out now, like Kelly Sue DeConnick's Bitch Planet, which is completely motivated by rage, like front and center, and it is incredibly transformative, and it is really awesome. Sorry, that was
so I was going to talk a bit about different modes of apocalypse and salvation, apropos like whether or not humans should feel ashamed for being humans.
Sit in the corner.
I am not going to apologize for being human.
No, me neither, right? And that's, I think, at its best, science fiction and the political left have been Promethean. They've had the idea that humans are the solution. If humans are the problem, then humans are also the solution. That we don't have a problem with too many humans. We have a problem with like not good enough ways to organize the humans we have. And that the way that we do that is by adding technology. And if the technology doesn't work, then we humans steer the technology until it's better. That has been a historic mode of a kind of triumphant left-wing and science fiction and sometimes right-wing view of the future. And against that, starting with the kind of pastoralist, but especially picking up steam with the environmental movement, has been an idea that the solution to humans despoiling the planet is that humans are a problem and can never be the solution. And that the way that we get to a solution is by reducing humans to whatever the carrying capacity is, which we make up a number and then we multiply it by a big number and it turns out to be an even bigger number because any imaginary number multiplied by a sufficiently large number is also very large. And we declare humans to be like shameful on the earth, and it creates a certain kind of smug satisfaction in post-apocalyptic stories, first of all, in which we are radically depopulated, but also in which humans, in the absence of society, kind of turn into total jerks. And there is something Promethean about writing a story and imagining a future in which our pastoralism is reclaimed by figuring out how to live together in big cities so that we don't need to eat up tons of habitat with like tract housing, and instead we find super efficient cooperative ways to live in really dense environments, and in which we use technology that works for people instead of, you know, for transhuman immortal life forms called limited liability corporations that use people as their inconvenient gut flora, so that we take things like, you know, GMO crops, and we figure out how to grow plants in much more condensed environments with fewer energy inputs that also do environmental remediation, instead of saying, well, we're going to grow everything in this kind of faux 17th century pastoralist way that we call organic that involves using ever larger tracts of land to feed people. And then when we point out that that's a problem, we say, okay, we'll just get rid of 4 billion people and the problem will be solved. And I really like this corner that we've turned, I think, in some of the way that we think about our future, and this return to this idea that the problem isn't technology, the problem is our relationship with it. The problem is allowing technology to be declared to be an inevitable force of history instead of a thing that humans make and humans steer. And I talked about it a little on the panel this morning, but I'll repeat it. Ada Palmer is this historian that we all know who writes novels for Tor. She wrote this amazing book called
Like the Lightning.
To Like the Lightning, thank you. And she runs at the University of Chicago. Every year she runs this exercise where her undergrads have to spend weeks gaming out the election of the Medici's Pope. And she assigns them all roles. And they spend weeks doing it. And at the end of the weeks every year, some of the candidates are always in the running because the forces of history will always drive those people to the fore. And some of the candidates are always wild cards and are completely contestable because the forces of history exist in contention with the forces of human agency that individuals can make differences in. And all the parts that are inevitable were contestable by humans one round back or two rounds back in the game. And so that idea of being able to both live in a world in which the decisions of your ancestors have put you on a course, but also in which the decisions that we make today can alter that course. That's a move that science fiction makes, but it's a move that like is also a foundationally hopeful one that I think we're doing in our politics increasingly too.
Yeah, and actually you mentioning that some of the candidates were wild cards made me think of George R. R. Martin, which made me think of the fact that we've kind of been living in the era of Game of Thrones the last like several years, and that is this profoundly misanthropic view of human beings and politics and human interactions that I think, you know, we may have now be reaching the end of. We may now be reaching the end of.
Well, the series is going to end.
The series is going to end, but I think that we also, it's not just Game of Thrones, it's like a million Game of Thrones knockoffs. It's like every book for like 5 years had to be Game of Thrones with elves or Game of Thrones on a space station or, you know, Game of Thrones with a hat, Game of Thrones with a cat.
Uber for Game of Thrones.
Boat, Game of Thrones with a stoat.
One throne, two throne, red throne, blue throne.
You know, and I feel like, you know, things go through fads. Everything had to be Hunger Games for a while too. But, you know, I feel like that misanthropic dystopian view of politics is maybe something that we now are reaching the end of wanting to explore, and perhaps now we can actually have ideas of politics that are, you know, like actually The Collapsing Empire has some very cynical stuff in it, but it also has people who want to do the right thing and are not completely hopeless. One thing I wanted to just mention or kind of bring into the conversation about science fiction and the resistance that's another kind of strand that I've been thinking about a lot lately is building community. And I think that, you know, a lot of science fiction authors, a lot of authors in general, tend to be very solitary and very, like, and a little bit, you know, stupidly competitive. Stupidly in the sense that, like, it doesn't actually make sense to be competitive, but we still do it.
Yeah, it's not a zero-sum game.
It's not a zero-sum game. You know, J.K. Rowling made a lot of other people's careers when she became successful. But, you know, I think that you can't really imagine the best futures or the most interesting futures or the most diverse futures or, you know, just the most inspirational, helpful futures on your own. It takes a lot of us talking and working together and reading each other's stuff and saying, well, oh, you did this thing, but I have an idea. And, you know, just cooperating to some extent, not as co-authors, but as like parts of this community of writers who all want to engage in this imaginative exercise. And I think that, you know, I'm really encouraged by a lot of the signs that I've seen lately of people coming together to do this.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but it's also the fact that science fiction in particular is, and I'm going to get all philosophical on you because I have a philosophy degree and this is one of my few opportunities to use it. Science fiction is, as a genre, has been explicitly Hegelian, right? Where there has been the thesis of Campbellian science fiction with the competent, you know, the competent man, and then the antithesis of that has, the confident man, but the antithesis was of that was the British New Wave of science fiction, which was fundamentally more pessimistic, more literary, and more, you know, sort of just generally artistic. And with that came the synergy of a whole new generation of writers. And it continues to do that, partly because science fiction has always explicitly, not only explicitly been a community, you know, founded in the letters department of the Hugo Gernsback's electrical, you know, magazines, but also from the very first has been a place where schisms has happened. The very first Worldcon, 39, I believe, they had their first schism where like half the people, the futurists, were all kicked out because they were commies, you know. And so right from the beginning, you had those schisms and the reintegrations. Science fiction as a community or as a genre has always been rooted in that community, and there's always been those schisms. Famously, again, we mentioned this yesterday during the Vietnam War. There was the Forum, which was a publication of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, where one full page ad was people supporting the war in Vietnam, and it had like 60 signatures. And on the other side was science fiction authors explicitly condemning the war in Vietnam, with the same number, and they were just, you know...
Same names.
And yet, there were a couple times where I was just looking there, I was like, I did not expect you to be on this page and you to be on that page. But, so that I think that the community is there, but I do think it one of the things that does make it function and which does make it a good literature of resistance is that resistance is built in because it is Hegelian, that there is always going to be a group of people who says this mainstream thought in science fiction has gone on too far, it has homogeny, it's, you know, and we need to resist it. And because it has that in its DNA, it makes it in some ways the potential to be an ideal literature of resistance just because of the people who write it.
But also, let's get to the synthesis part, because I think one of the big themes in science fiction has always been team building. and you know, bringing the gang together, bringing them back together, forming them. And one of the things that's been kind of hopeful for me is watching the kind of obsession with things like Walking Dead or Game of Thrones kind of dying out. Both of those are about the disintegration of community, right? It's all about how you can't form a coalition because everyone's going to stab you in the back or eat you or throw you off to the people who will eat you. And now you have the rise of like a show like The Expanse, which has been really quite, which is about team building. It's not like it's an easy future. It's, you know, some might say that there are dystopian themes in this story about class warfare in the solar system. But the main characters are always trying to build coalitions and trying to bring together disparate groups. And there's been so many scenes in that series, and some of it is from the original book series, but some of it is original to the television series, where you think that a scene is going in one direction, you think that people are about to suddenly start murdering each other, and this, and it will actually resolve with the characters actually getting together and working to save as many lives as possible. And I think that that is a very strong theme in science fiction, and I'm going to say something that might sound a little counterintuitive, but I think that the trend toward superhero narratives, which are about bringing together multiple heroes as a team, can actually be part of that turn away from the kind of disintegration of community. So say what you will about the Avengers, the Justice League, the X-Men movies. I mean, they don't always work as films. We were just talking about this earlier, like we're having some trepidation about Justice League. But the first Avengers film, the reason why that was exciting was not because like, oh wow, we got to see like Iron Man and Hulk like kissing or whatever they were doing. Which, I mean, I kind of wish they were. I would watch, like that's a whole other series that Anna Lee will have in her mind. But part of what made that film work was that sense of bringing a community together and bringing together a different, you know, a group of people with different powers. And so that to me, what do you want?
I'm waiting for you to finish your thought because I want to say something, but I'm going to wait until you're done.
Okay, thank you. All I was going to say to finish off as part of this team exercise here of all of us talking about this together is that this is, again, something that science fiction has always done really well as part of the genre is imagine what it's like not just to bring humans together, but to bridge worlds, to bring humans together with non-humans, to bring humans together with non-human animals that we have learned how to uplift, for example, although not in the Planet of the Apes movies, too bad. But that would be great, and that is a kind of strand in science fiction. And also bringing humans together with artificial intelligences. And so I think that, again, there's all these ways in which science fiction imagines bridging boundaries, crossing borders, eliminating borders, which I would love to see happen one day in the real world too. So that's a utopian strand in science fiction, which can be a hard road. And I think the idea of a hard utopia or a hard-won utopia is really important to keep in mind. Okay, now what were you going to say?
The thought that I had as she was talking about Avengers and then she talked about the Iron Man and Hulk kissing. But just crystallized
image,
in my brain, and I realized that one of science fiction's most powerful subgenres of resistance is fan fiction. And
yes.
Because it is literally, we want these stories, and you won't give us these stories. For whatever reason, you're not going to give us these stories. So screw you, we're going to make these stories anyway, and Bruce and Tony are gonna kiss the whole night long.
So
right, and the result of that is and that is a fundamental thing of what we were talking about the synthesis thing of that you get people who are engaged in science fiction, who are writing science fiction or fantasy, and who are saying, this is a road I want. This is a road that I'm going to forge. This is the world I want to see. And in one sense, it's just about Tony and Bruce kissing. But the fact that we're just sitting here going, oh yeah, Tony and Bruce kissing, that's awesome. We could not have done that a quarter century ago. And a lot of the fact that we can right now, to some extent, can be laid at the feet, very positively, of the fanficers. So all you fanfic writers out there, yes.
And I wanted to add one more thing before Corey says something, which is that the other part about fanfic that is so terrific and that has changed the genre so much is that, especially early on in the 1960s and 70s, a lot of fanfic was written by women, and it had romance themes. And romance had traditionally been anathema to science fiction because there was this notion that sci-fi was for men and men don't like romance, both of which are not true, but that was the kind of stereotype of who men were and what science fiction should be. And so I think that as fanfic has become more mainstream and as it has entered into the genre and that writers of fanfic have entered the genre, romance has become a bigger and bigger part of science fiction. And that is also a form of utopian resistance because, again, that's a way of forming a coalition. That's a way of prioritizing love. It's a way of thinking realistically about how humans work. And so I just, again, this is just to say that I think the fact that fans have gotten so involved in the genre has really been transformational. And Corey, what did you want to say? Sorry.
Well, I wanted to talk, in fact, you've nicely teed up the thing I wanted to say. So
excellent.
It's true that science fiction writers have often competed with one another and that there's often this sense that, well, I invented that. Who are you to go and remix it? And yet at the same time, of course, everything that we've invented by remixing something someone else made. And, you know, when we're honest with ourselves, we know this, right? But when we're dishonest with ourselves, we engage in the Lockean fantasy, which is that the thing that you made was like plumbing that was lying around for anyone to take. And then I mixed it with my special labor and turned it into, you know, a butterfly. And that's not for anyone to catch. That's, you know, butterflies aren't plumbing. Butterflies are beautiful butterflies. And of course, eventually they fall to the ground and they decompose and become plumbing somehow for the next person.
I'm really confused.
And
it's
a very clear metaphor.
It all goes back to single-celled organisms, okay?
Yeah. Single-celled organisms. So the point being that this like kind of Lockean fallacy of when I do it, it's art, and when you do it, it's theft, is something that science fiction at its best is really good at pointing out, because one of science fiction's cool moves is imagine a Martian looking at the Earth through a telescope and trying to figure out why, when, you know, Edgar Allan Poe invents detective stories and then we all write detective stories, that's okay. But when someone takes Gone with the Wind and rewrites it from the point of view of the African-American enslaved people, that is a copyright infringement. Which part of inventing the entire genre of detective stories is not worthy of special protections? Or contrary-wise, if that isn't, then why is the preciousness of dead Margaret Mitchell allowed to stop the living authors from expressing themselves? So this is a great move. Now, what's really funny to note about this is that science fiction writers, even though we are capable of writing the stories in which we elevate ourselves out of the kind of muddle of our jealousy and pettiness and, you know, mean-spiritedness and self-serving bullshit, we then fall prey to it, which is really interesting, but our readers read it, and they go on to create fanfic.
Yeah.
And then awesome. They fall prey to it and go, why are you ripping off my fanfic? That's my fanfic that I made by ripping. And it is this amazing circle of both rationalism and self-serving crap that we are engaged in that, like, maybe gives us hope for the future.
Humans, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I have a slight change of topic. I've had the same conversation like multiple times lately where I've been talking to other authors and they've said, I'm having to work really, really, really hard to make my villain in my story or my novel not basically a copy of Donald Trump. And it's not because they set out to put Donald Trump in their story. It's partly because all of the advice you get on how to create a compelling villain leads to Donald Trump. I mean, it just does. Like, it leads to some version of Donald Trump. And also just that he is everywhere right now, and it's really hard to shut him out. And the reason why they don't... Okay, we're going to have questions in a minute. The reason why they don't want to have Donald Trump as the villain of their story is not because they're afraid of offending his followers, because most of these people don't care about that. It's because they don't want to be too on the nose. And I've wrestled with that a little bit myself. I have a novel that I just finished, and there are some a few bad people in it, or people who are kind of a little bit sociopathic, and they got a little bit of Trump in them. I've got some other stories I'm working on. I think it's almost inevitable because, again, the thing of like all of the advice on how to create a compelling villain does lead to some version of that, someone who thinks that they're doing the right thing, someone who is very delusional and self-deluding, and someone who is, you know, an egomaniac. Those are all qualities that make a really, really strong villain. The other thing I was going to say super fast that I said yesterday is that you can also, instead of writing the, like, fuck Donald Trump story, which I'm all for that, you can write about larger themes, which I think we all are doing, of, like, how do you create a fair society? How do you solve the problems of technology? How do you live on this planet or whatever planet you're on in an ethical way that don't have, like, that are much bigger and broader than how do we get rid of this asshole? You know, and I think that that's also a very political act. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, and to wrap that up and then get to the point where we're going into the questions, I think you bring up a really important point, which is, and this is true, I've said this before, and I'll say it again many, many times, all science fiction or fantasy is about another time. But the people who are writing it and the people who are reading it live now. So, of course, you know, the science fiction writers and fantasy writers and speculative writers are going to be thinking about Donald Trump just in the same way they were thinking about, you know, someone like Obama, you know, 8 years ago in a different way, probably. But, you know, or George Bush or Ronald Reagan. Of course, they're going to be thinking about what's going on in their lives and the lives of the people that they know and care about. All of that is always going to be there, and that is part of the reason, again, why science fiction is and fantasy and speculative fiction in general is so compelling, because no matter where we place it, it is always speaking to our time. And that is, again, why, as a literature of resistance, it's so important for us to acknowledge that we are people of our time. So
yeah, I'm going to introduce how we do our Q&A here.
Yes.
We like to call alternately on people who identify as women or non-binary, people who identify as male or non-binary. There's someone with a mic. We'll call on you. A long rambling statement followed by what do you think of that is technically a question, but it is not a good question. Can we open with someone who identifies as woman or non-binary, please? Hands up. Yeah. Back there, back row, mic runner. Middle of the back row of the first section, middle
right,
section.
Right there. Right, you're right over there. Right over there. Nope, no. Oh,
never mind.
Oh, okay, that's fine.
Oh, I was. We were pointing at two different people.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
And I apologize if we misidentify someone's gender.
Right, we're going to let you run that.
All right. I'm
Hi.
In cargo.
Hi. Thank you so much. So, a question is related to what you're talking about, villains. So, when I think about the resistance, I think about the characters that have made me feel have embodied resistance. Obviously, you know, Star Wars and all of that. And so I'm thinking about what do you guys think about characters and how you set your characters? Do you do it differently now than you did pre-election?
I'm for character. And I don't think that I do them particularly different. I mean, what I do think about are circumstances that are different because, again, we're living in the world that we do now. But I've always tried to have... speaking for myself, and the other folks up here can speak for themselves, I've always had to have them try to deal with whatever they're dealing with in as realistic way as possible, given who their characters are supposed to be. So that doesn't change. That doesn't change too much.
Yeah, I mean, I said yesterday that I hope everybody who grew up reading about Katniss Everdeen wants to be Katniss Everdeen when they grow up, and I hope that happens. I don't think my approach to character has changed that much because it is really about the thing that Corey was talking about, getting to the emotion, getting to the personal stuff. And if I let the extraneous, you know, world politics stuff get into that too much, I end up with someone who's a cipher and not a real person. So that's something that I try not to do.
It hasn't changed that much for me either. But what I will say is that for me, and I think for a lot of us, what feels like the kind of character who I think of as being one who resists well and makes my heart kind of swell when I see them is someone who always reaches out for other people and brings them along and never does it on their own and maybe admits that they can't do it on their own. And so to me, that's the feeling of like true heroism when I see that happen.
I'm writing a third little brother novel, and I started writing it before the Trump campaign kicked off the 2016 election cycle. But it was informed in part by things like the proto-Trumpism in Turkey and in other places, you know, Poland and Hungary, and in the UK. And I am writing a point of view character who has sold out completely, and who's thinking through how she got there, and who does a lot of things around the periphery to try and make herself feel okay about having sold out, and is confronting the fact that, you know, if you do wickedness all day long and then try to redeem yourself with goodness, it's not a balance sheet, and that they don't balance out, and the one stains your soul no matter what, and is trying to work it out. And it's a tough book, but I feel like, and I don't know how it ends, but I feel like she's going to get a hell of a redemption or a comeuppance or both when we get to the ending there.
A redumpance.
Redumpance. I think I had one of those once. Gentlemen,
after used copy.
Right. I can't see who that is with their hand up. Is that Art? Back there with the blue tartan shirt. That yes, yeah. You sir. Yeah. Sorry.
Tartan.
Thank you.
Tartan. What would you call it?
It's a plaid. Thanks.
Plaid.
Plaid. All right.
Plaid. Yes. Yes.
Tartan
plaid.
Is fine.
That works. I just wanted to ask you guys a question concerning, I guess, science fiction writing, and we're talking about the resistance, right? Well, it seems like right now we're talking about the resistance because we have Trump and Trumpism. It's come into play. But I just came from a couple conversations before this with like Alicia Garza and Stephen Phillips and people who are been part of the who are in the Black community, right? Who are people of color who are coming from communities that have been dealing with themes of resistance for centuries, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So being part of like the white liberal base, right, on the coasts, I think for a lot of our lives we've kind of like lost that and gotten sort of blinded with our own sort of view of what the resistance should be and is now.
Is there a question?
Yes. So
sorry.
It's getting there. Sorry. So what I wanted to ask was, in terms of like science fiction, you know, we talk about things like being colorblind and that's, we got to...
No, we do not.
Right.
No, we do not.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you know, we have to recognize that, no, there is color, there are different genders and there are different people who need to be uplifted and supported
And
the question is, in science fiction, do you see that in your writing or just in general, in the writings that are out there, do you see that as translatable to the main base of readers who might be coming from the white liberal base?
Why would we care? I mean, quite honestly, if we're writing something that is not necessarily for the white liberal base, that doesn't mean that there isn't an audience for it that is not someone who's going to be affected by it. You don't have to think about the white liberal first. And I can say that because I can live on the coast. I live in a goddamn Ohio in a county that went 78% for Trump. One of the things that I think is really important, and we talked about it very briefly yesterday, and it was addressed here as well, is that, you know, speaking as the straight white man, you cannot have resistance that only goes through me. You can't have resistance that only goes through Corey. You can't have one that only goes through Anna Lee, and you can't have one that only goes through Charlie Jane. Everything we write does not have to be translatable to everybody else. There can be things that are written that are not for me, because I will look at them and go, I don't know how to approach this. We are not at the apex of political or social thought. And the more that we don't recognize that, the more we are vulnerable to, you know, failure. So quite frankly, if, you know, Nora Jemison or Nisi Shaw or Daniel Jose Older write something, I'm not, the first question to ask is not, what will the white liberal think? Fuck the white liberal. Let that work find the right audience. Next.
Yeah, there. Yeah, blue scarf. Thank you.
All right. Next question.
Yeah, here we go. So, as a brown woman from the Global South who reads and loves all of you, thank you. But, John, you started answering my question, but the question is, given it's about resistance, who are the Black and people of color science fiction writers you read?
Well, I mean, I'm in love with Nora Jemison's writing in a way that's probably not healthy, but I mean, everything about her is fantastic. Niecy Shell's Everfair is tremendously wonderful. Needy Okorafor is great. Ken Liu, whose fantasy series is fabulous, and I'm going to stop talking now so everybody else can suggest people.
Yeah, I mean, we were just hanging out with Cecilia Tan yesterday, who I think is a very underrated science fiction writer. I was lucky enough to go to Hong Kong recently and hang out with a bunch of mainland Chinese authors who are doing incredible work that I feel, you know, needs to be... It's being translated into English largely by Ken Liu, and Cixin Liu obviously is in the forefront of that, but there's a lot of great people in mainland China right now who are writing incredible stuff. There's just so many great writers right now who are... you know, breaking out, and I feel like it's a really exciting time. Yunha Li was on the Nebula ballot. His stuff is amazing. Just so many great people.
Saladin Ahmed, who's a great fantasy writer. The sequel to his novel is coming out finally. Very excited about that. Charles Yu, who writes sort of literary science fiction that's hilarious. I love his work, and he also worked on Westworld as well, which was really great. So, yeah, I mean, like Charlie said, there's tons of others. You want to, like...
I grew up with Nala Hopkinson in Toronto.
Oh,
she
God,
is amazing.
Yes.
Yeah,
she's
always amazing.
God, yes.
You Californians are so lucky to have got her now. and then my former recent writing student, Alicia Wong, is killing it.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, Alyssa.
And also Amal El-Motar, who won a Nebula just recently.
Yes.
So she's coming up. And there's tons.
We could be here all night.
Oh, yeah. Aliyah really Don Johnson is another great up-and-coming writer.
Yes.
Yeah, love her stuff. So much.
All right.
Person down here, brown jacket. Okay. Yep.
Sorry, two quick things. First of all, I wanted you to just run this theory by you. Trump shape-shifting lizard. Up down.
David Icky. It sounds like David Icky. Icky.
No, Trump's a human, and that's our problem.
Yeah, let's not denigrate lizards. I mean, come on.
Oh my God.
The second thing is, what's wrong with pessimism? I feel like everybody hates on pessimism, which is a little ironic, but it's useful. There are a lot of uses of some well-placed pessimism.
So
I'll take that.
You go ahead.
I'll take that, actually. So, you know, my novel, All the Birds of the Sky, came out last year, and some people said that it was an apocalyptic novel or that it had some very dark predictions about the future. And what I said in interview after interview was that writing a dystopia is an optimistic act because you think that we can learn something or that we can get something from that that'll help us to deal. Writing a disaster story is an optimistic act. Writing about like the worst case scenario and people behaving at their worst is an optimistic act because we're arming ourselves, we are preparing ourselves for that, and you believe that we can actually get something out of that that's useful and that we will survive. So I'm actually pro-pessimism in some cases, but I also do really love optimism, especially when pessimism is the dominant mode in our discourse. So
I want to say that I think that optimism and pessimism are the wrong frame because they're both predictive. They both make predictions about the future. We're not fortune tellers. No one knows what the future will be. The future is contestable. It matters. What we do changes the future. So fuck prediction, right? Fuck optimism and pessimism. Hope, though, is the belief that if you take any course of action that materially improves your situation now, that having done so, another course of action that might improve your situation further might become apparent, right? Hope is why when your ship sinks in the sea, you tread water, not because realistically you have a chance of being rescued, but because everyone who was rescued treaded water until rescue arrived. It is the necessary but insufficient precondition for progress, right? And so hope is what gives you the strength, not just to kick until rescue arrives, but the strength to put someone else's arms around your neck and kick for them too if they've lost hope. And so I'm all for hope, but fuck pessimism and fuck optimism.
But yay, Optimus Prime.
Yeah. That said, it's fun to write pessimistic stuff, just to write it. But yes, cosign 100%.
Yeah, and I would say that for me, the problem with pessimism, I mean, just to amplify what Corey's saying, really, is that pessimism leaves you paralyzed. And I see a lot of this in, because I write a lot about environmental science in my nonfiction life, and I see a lot of people saying things like, there's just nothing we can do, we're killing animals, we're killing plants, we're killing the ecosystem, we're just screwed forever. And the answer to that is not, okay, well, let's just do nothing. The answer is, like, we've got to jump in and do stuff. And I feel like pessimism just doesn't leave you that out. So I think, yeah, have a little darkness, but there need to be solutions at the end of that darkness, and there needs to be hope, more than anything, hope.
So we have time for one question from a person who identifies as a female or non-binary, and I see a woman back there with her arm up. So if the mic runner could zip over, and we'll be quick, you'll be quick, and then we'll all go and make your books non-returnable with Sharpies.
Yay. Hi, quick. Two questions. Number one, speaking of pessimism, if you have ever experienced like being told you're not a real minority in the publishing world, like, do you bother to fight that? And if you see offensive things about your minority from well-meaning people in the publishing industry, do you bother to fight that? Or do you just keep writing? Or you could just tell me get off of Twitter. And number two, I'll leave it like, what do you recommend for a learning disabled girl that was kicked out of chemistry class but loves black holes and wants to put a sci-fi element in her urban fantasy book that real hard sci-fi people will like? Do you recommend anything for that? So just that.
I recommend tossing out the idea that there's a difference between hard sci-fi and soft sci-fi. That's just crap.
Yeah.
There's science fiction. It's speculation about science. Have at it. Like, you don't have to worry about, pleasing some hard person over there. But you certainly can. There's tons of science resources online. And one of the secret things about scientists is that they love to speculate about stuff. And I've been really lucky in my science fiction work that I've been able to just contact scientists by email, call them up, and say, hey, I have this idea for like a weird drug that would get people addicted to work, which is in my novel. And I got neuroscientists to talk to me about it. They really do want to talk about that stuff. So if you're wondering about how to bring science into your work, talk to scientists and give them a chance to kind of participate in creating that science fiction. It's really fun for everybody.
I once toured a super collider with my friend Patricia York, who has since passed on, but who was a sweet middle-aged school teacher from upstate New York who just kept trying to get our guide to explain how you'd kill someone with a super collider.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can add to that is that this whole thing of mixing science fiction and fantasy, which came up a lot with my book, I feel like that's increasingly less relevant. I think that a lot of science fiction is kind of fantasy, and a lot of fantasy has science in it. And people like N.K. Jemisin, trying to categorize her work as science fiction or fantasy is just foolishness. It's brilliant writing. It's brilliant speculation. We don't need to be like mashed potatoes over here and peas over here. It doesn't make any sense.
All right, it is time on Sprockets to go and sign your
books.
Thank you all for coming.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.